Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. In the War Report, we examine recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world and see how these events affect global stability and U.S. national security. In the War Report last month, we discussed the strategic importance of the U.S.-Japanese alliance. In a recent television address, the Emperor of Japan, Akihito, told his people that he was considering retiring from his position and turning over control to his son, Naruhito, who is 56 years old. Marshawn, is there more to this announcement than meets the eye?
Well, I absolutely think there's a lot more to this than meets the eye. I mean, when you look at Japanese history, one of the things that you have to understand about Japanese politics is that it is more or less a two-level system. On the one hand, you have your elites, and those are your generals, your prime minister, your senior politicians. And then below them, you have everybody else. And everybody else sort of adheres to the national idea, which traditionally has been that the emperor is divine, the emperor is a living god, and the emperor knows what is best for us. And everything is ultimately done in the name of the emperor. This has changed a bit since the end of World War II, but basically something very rooted in Japanese society. On the other hand, the power elites in Japan know the emperor, well, they may or may not believe necessarily that he's god. They also believe that it is the right thing to do to manipulate the will of God, if you will. Sometimes you got to nudge God in the right direction. And this has taken place in Japanese history. During Japan's many civil wars, and even during attempted coup d'etats, both the coup plotters and the counter-coup were all doing what they did in the name of the emperor. So too, during the Japanese civil wars, both sides fought in the name of the emperor. This would kind of be tantamount to the English Civil War if both sides were fighting for the crown. And so it's really, it's a very unique situation, but certainly in Japanese history, emperor hasn't resigned in, I believe, 200 years. But it's all, there's also been suspicion that previous emperors have been murdered. The Emperor Meiji, who he was the architect of the Meiji Restoration.
And this is the 19th century following the opening of Japan by the United States through Commodore Perry.
Exactly. Now, how much was Emperor Meiji's idea and how much of it was his generals telling him what to do is anybody's guess. The Restoration, which was named after him, was the modernization of Japan. Well, his father was opposed to that. His father wanted to throw the barbarians, quote-unquote, the Westerners, the Americans, the French, the British, out of Japan. And he mysteriously contracted smallpox and died. Coincidentally, the last Tokugawa shogun also got ill and died around the same time. So, again, the Japanese elites are not beyond manipulating the emperor, or even possibly, and there is plenty of historical debate on this, but possibly murdering the emperor to further their ends. And certainly, that may be what we are seeing in Japan. We are certainly seeing the rise of the militarists, which the current Emperor Akihito has very much been opposed to Japanese militarism. He has been a staunch pacifist. So it would make sense that if you were leading a militarist government, which is what the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is, he is a militarist, he's a member of the Nippon Kogai, which is a militant Japanese nationalist organization, it makes sense that naturally they would clash. And of course, Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister, having ultimately more power and influence, would nudge the emperor out of the picture if he knows that this emperor will not play ball. And, of course, there is plausible reason. The emperor is ill, and the emperor is elderly.
Yes, he's 82 years old, and he did have operations for cancer and for a heart problem, although he appeared to be in very good health, and that's what he said in the TV address.
That is also part of the stoic Japanese nature, to not show weakness. He may not necessarily have the will or the political influence to fight the rise of the nationalists. Again, this was something we've seen in Japanese history. If you look back to the 1920s and 30s, leaders of Japan have periodically been murdered. There were coup attempts. There were prime ministers in Japan that were murdered between the 1920s and the 1930s and the rise of Japanese nationalism.
This is really the predecessor to World War II, as Japan started to conquer its neighbors in Asia, and including China.
Exactly. And there were a lot of elements in Japan that opposed this, and gradually they would die. And so it is possible that these nationalist elements are forcing the elderly emperor to step down. And again, he is a pacifist. It would not be within his character to resist. It would not be within his character to resist with force.
Nor would he be an effective figurehead if a new nationalist government was starting to push militarism and expansionism in Japan. Do we know the attitude of the emperor's son, Naruhito?
Naruhito is an interesting figure because he broke with Japanese tradition and he married a commoner, which is something that hadn't really happened before. They'd always married within the imperial court. We know that he is a bit of a social rebel in a way, but what his attitudes towards the militarists may be, I mean, again, relatively speaking, he's a young man. He's in his 50s. So the way he might be looking at the situation would be a little bit different than his father. Being able to step in, being able to become emperor at such a relative young age might play a role in how the militarists can manipulate him. And ultimately, there is always going to be an element of tradition. Everyone in Japanese society knows their place. We have to remember that Japanese society is a very orderly society. It is a very top-down society. And we have to remember that the emperor, albeit in public, is placed above everyone else. Like I say, according to the Shinto religion, the emperor is divine. Ultimately, politically speaking, the emperor is going to be below whatever clique currently rules Japan. Whether we're talking the shoguns who ruled Japan from the 12th century up until the 1860s, or the generals who then ruled Japan from the 1860s up until 1945.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Now, Marchand, can you talk about the important change in the Japanese constitution that affects this nationalist revival?
The Japanese constitution pledges Japan to pacifism and permits Japan only a self-defense force. So they did away with the imperial army, and it became the Japanese ground self-defense force, the Japanese air self-defense force, et cetera, et cetera. There was a clause, or there is, I should say, a clause in the Japanese constitution which permits the Japanese to fight in self-defense. It forbids them from wars of aggression, but allows them to fight in self-defense, but also in defense of their allies, namely the United States. That's why the Japanese were able to deploy soldiers to Iraq during the Iraq War. However, the Japanese did not deploy in a combat role. They deployed with doctors and with engineers and things like that. There were no offensive capabilities. That was the first deployment of Japanese soldiers overseas since World War II. But what happened in January of 2016 is truly revolutionary. The Constitution was reinterpreted so that the Mutual Defense Clause could be reinterpreted to say that the Japanese Army can, in instances of mutual defense, take part in offensive operations because they're forbidden from wars of aggression. But the law does not specify that the Japanese Army cannot engage in offensive operations so long as it is part of, quote-unquote, mutual defense. So this means that if the United States were to invade North Korea, or we were to go to war with the Chinese, or Japan were to feel its territorial integrity threatened, Japan can argue self-defense or mutual defense and immediately go on the offensive. This was opposed by the more liberal members of the Japanese Diet, the traditional pacifists, the Japanese Diet, which is the Japanese parliament. But the nationalists ultimately prevailed and passed this amendment, or should I say, reinterpretation of the Japanese Constitution. We have to remember that during World War II, though, Japan always fought in the name of peace in Asia. So the Japanese are the ultimate legalists, if you will. Legalism was invented in Asia, after all.
Marchand, can you talk about Japan's military program to develop a new land-to-sea missile?
Absolutely. Well, the details of it are not entirely known yet, but the Japanese do appear to be developing, and again, this would be considered defensive/offensive. It is an offensive weapon for all intents and purposes. It allows you to attack enemy ships from the land. So it's not like our Patriot missile batteries. This is a weapon with offensive capabilities. And the Japanese are looking to develop it in order to deploy to the islands around the disputed territories in the Senkoku Islands right now, where the Japanese are in a disagreement with the Chinese. The situation has actually recently escalated when the Chinese sailed a whole bunch of Coast Guard vessels, some believed to be armed, off the coast of the Senkoku Islands in a show of force. So the Japanese are ultimately looking, it seems, they're looking for a means to counter the Chinese Navy and counter the threat of the Chinese Coast Guard. What's important to remember is that the Japanese Navy is not the force it was during World War II. It is significantly smaller. The Japanese are rebuilding, they are rearming, but they're looking towards more high-tech weapons to even the technological gap. A good example of this would be the use of the surface-to-air missiles and the SAGR anti-tank missiles by the Egyptians during the 1973 war in order to make up for their own shortcomings, their own lack of a significant air force, their own shortcomings in their armored divisions. They made up for by using technology to sort of as a force multiplier, I should say. That's what it appears the Japanese are trying to do with this new land-to-sea missile.
Would you say that a revival of Japan's nationalism and its rebuilding its military is necessary if Japan is to be an effective counterweight to China, which has emerged as the U.S. principal rival in the Pacific?
Absolutely. From Go, we made a mistake at the end of World War II. What we did with Germany at the end of World War II is we rearmed the German army. They became the Federal Army of West Germany and the Bundeswehr, and we turned them around and we faced them towards the Soviets. The Japanese, we didn't. We dumped all their arms into Tokyo Bay, and we declared that Japan was a pacifist state and they would never have an army again. Well, this was a massive mistake because what this means, first of all, is that what should have been our staunch ally in the Pacific, our staunch bastion against communism, now became nothing more than a speed bump. And of course, it now led to ultimately a far greater, the pendulum always swings back. We forget this, but the pendulum swings in one direction, it will swing back in the other direction. So it means we're going to have a much more fervent, much more militant nationalism in Japan than we would have if we had just rearmed the Japanese in the first place. But that having been said, what's done cannot be undone, as Shakespeare once said, which means that ultimately, a nationalist Japan is better than a pacifist Japan, because right now China is seizing territory in the Pacific. We have the South Koreans, who are a great ally. Their army is phenomenal. I have met soldiers of the Army of the Republic of Korea. They are phenomenal soldiers. But the problem is their army is very, very small and is predominantly focused on the main threat from North Korea. So if China decides to start trampling on its neighbors, or more to the point, advance across the Pacific towards the United States, South Korea really, again, will be a small diversion for the Chinese. Japan provides the only real effective buffer.
Now, Marshawn, how about the militaries of Vietnam or Philippines, other nations that might challenge China's claim to the South China Sea?
In the case of Vietnam, I am always far more skeptical of the Vietnamese than, ironically, I think, some of our politicians like John Kerry are. I mean, I'm personally skeptical of the idea of arming communists, given the fact that we shipped anti-ship missiles to the Vietnamese in order to counterweight China. That was done actually this year. But the Vietnamese are not going to truly challenge the Chinese, I believe. Their army is predominantly oriented towards self-defense. It really is, in many ways, a self-defense army. They can project some power in places like Cambodia. They did overthrow the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. That having been said, their army is much more focused on defense of its own territorial integrity. Additionally, at the end of the day, China and Vietnam are both communists. They both have common ground. While we tended to think of communism as being a dead ideology after the fall of the Soviet Union, it does automatically give Vietnam and China some ground. While they have in the past had territorial disputes, ultimately, the enemy you know is better than the one you don't know. They know China. They've been frenemies, if you will, with China is the best way to put it, because they have fought territorial disputes. But again, at the end of the day, China can offer a far greater carrot to Vietnam than we can in terms of investment, in terms of military hardware, in terms of overall technological assets that China can offer them. So China's always going to be able to wield a lot more influence, both ideologically, economically, politically, and militarily over Vietnam. With the Philippines now, the Philippines do have a nationalist leader that may or may not stand up to China. He does talk about defending territorial integrity. But the Philippines is not going to provide a really sturdy buffer because the Philippines have their own problems. They're fighting a communist insurgency. They're also fighting a Muslim insurgency. And at the same time, they're trying to quell domestic unrest and quell a pervasive drug problem that exists in the Philippines. So their army is much more focused on internal security issues. The country's already divided. And its army is not particularly large or particularly well-equipped either. They would be very hard-pressed to stand up to a Chinese invasion. That only really leaves us Japan and South Korea as our only real buffer against the Chinese.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And we've been talking about recent events in Japan, including the announcement by the Japanese emperor that he was considering retiring and the renewal of Japanese nationalism and its revival of its military. Turning to the Mideast, Marchand, Libya has been engulfed in continual war since the United States led a NATO campaign to overthrow the Russian-allied Libyan government in 2011. The NATO air campaign destroyed much of Libya's infrastructure, including its modern irrigation system, and left the country in chaos. Jihadist fighters used by NATO to overthrow Libya now control parts of the country and are allied with the Islamic State. In an effort to combat IS's expansion, the U.S. has been conducting a bombing campaign against IS targets in Libya. The U.S. bombing campaign appears to have enabled the U.S.-backed Libyan government to capture IS's headquarters in Sirte. Marchand, seems like we're embroiled in this war forever. Could you remind me again, why did we overthrow the Libyan government in 2011?
If you want to get into the reason that this administration gave us and that Hillary Clinton's State Department gave us, it was that Gaddafi was shooting protesters, albeit we don't seem to have a problem with that when it's the government of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe doing it, but we do have a problem with it when it's Gaddafi. When you look at the policy of this administration, particularly in recent years, one of the patterns, consistent patterns you see is that everywhere we have found a significant Russian ally that is weak and vulnerable in the Middle East, the first thing we've attempted to do is overthrow them. We attempted to overthrow Bashar al-Assad in Syria. He was and still is a Russian ally. You look at Gaddafi in Libya, he had moved into the Russian sphere of influence. And then, of course, you look at our overthrowing of the government of Ukraine. From a military perspective and from a political perspective, we could live with Gaddafi, ultimately. You know, he turned over his chemical weapons. When we invaded Iraq, he was petrified. He was willing to do anything we wanted. Now, Gaddafi was a nice guy? No. Gaddafi was a dictator. He was a tyrant, of course he was. But we do business with tyrants all the time. Let's see the world from a perspective of realpolitik for a minute, and let's all not pretend we're naive. The fact is that we do business with dictators and tyrants every day. Gaddafi was somebody that we could ultimately have lived with because he imprisoned al-Qaeda militants, he imprisoned Wahhabi militants, the people who eventually became ISIS, and he was willing to do whatever we told him so long as we didn't overthrow his regime. That was fine. But now we bombed Libya, we killed Gaddafi, and the country fell into chaos, and then we basically said, well, it's not our problem, good luck, Libyan government. And then naturally, as one could expect, ISIS stepped in to fill the void.
As the Islamic State loses ground in conventional wars in Syria, Iraq, and Libya, it seems to be increasing its terror campaign in Europe. Of course, we had the 6 coordinated attacks in Paris last November that killed 130 people and injured hundreds more in Paris and its environs. Recently in Pakistan, IS bombed a hospital, killing at least 70 people, wounding more than 100. In Belgium, a terrorist recently attacked 2 police officers with a machete. In Germany last month, an attacker armed with a knife and an axe wounded 5 commuters on a train. What is the Islamic State hoping to accomplish with this terror campaign?
What it's hoping to accomplish is to wear down the West. When you look at prior terror campaigns, particularly again, looking at the IRA is one of my favorite examples. During the 1970s, 80s, and into the early 90s, the IRA was setting off bombs in London. It started a bombing campaign outside of Belfast and began bombing the streets of London. And the idea was to wear down the will to fight. Because it's one thing for people to say, well, we can drop some bombs over there, we can fight them over there. It's another thing when the bombs start going off in our neighborhoods. You have several categories of terrorist attack. You have the very complex, the kind like the 9/11 style attack. The problem with a terrorist attack like that is that it is far too complicated. You know, it's a one-off thing, you know. And then after that, you can't really ever one-up it again. You pretty much have shot all your ammunition in that one go. But what they're hoping for with these kind of pinprick attacks, the knifing attacks, the slashing attacks, the occasional shooting and bombing like we saw in San Bernardino, this is more or less to bleed the West through 1,000 cuts, because also the idea is the randomness of it. It's much harder to stop a lone wolf than it is to stop an organization planning complex attack, because how do you truly tell who's been ideologically inspired? as opposed to breaking down a network with leaders and intelligence operatives and whatnot. Now, it does have one crucial vulnerability, and the vulnerability of every terrorist organization is good intelligence on the part of the government. But the best example I can give is Mossad. The Israeli Mossad, one of the best intelligence agencies in the world, really has gotten breaking down terrorist organizations to a science. The reason is because they realize you can't stop the lone gunman. The idea that we can make every Muslim in this country register, and what's going to happen? The lone gunman is going to register himself as an atheist. They're not stupid. What the Israelis figured out is that you want to find the guys that make up that elite at the top of the terrorist organization. Often they're going to be nowhere near where the fighting is, much like the leaders of Hamas aren't in Gaza. A lot of them are in Turkey. A lot of them are in Algeria. They're not in Gaza. So when they're sending suicide bombers in to go do the dirty work, they're far away from the fighting. What the Israelis realize is you go out and you touch these guys. You find them and you assassinate them. It's easy for a terrorist leader or a terrorist commander or a terrorist strategist to say, I'm going to go send in suicide bombers into this American city. Well, I don't have the risk of getting killed myself. Well, once they start to fear for their own safety, once they know your intelligence operatives are going to find them and kill them, then it becomes much more difficult. Your goal is to eliminate the brains of the terrorist operation. And the best example of that was the assassination of Abu Jihad. The Israelis went in and the Mossad agents killed him personally. The Russians have followed the same model as the Israelis. Both the Israelis and the Russians have been much more effective at curbing terrorism than we have.
Isn't it liable to be counterproductive in the sense that as people are subjected to random attacks, they maybe get very upset and insist their governments come down as hard as possible on the Islamic State wherever it can be found?
It will definitely bring in a much heavier response or calls for a heavier response. But the most important thing is that it shows the ineffectiveness of our strategy. And that's the goal. If we want to end this and we want to end it now, we need to make peace with the Russians. Bashar al-Assad's going to stay in power. That's just a fact. All our attempts to overthrow him have only exacerbated the situation a thousandfold. What we need to do is cut a deal with the Russians. Say, okay, we're going to a new Sykes-Picot Treaty. We will divide up the Middle East between the two of us. And maybe give the Europeans a slice of the pie. And then we'll send boots on the ground into Iraq. The Russians already have boots on the ground in Syria. We're going to give ISIS something they didn't expect, which is a tremendous level of aggression and a tremendous offensive power coordinated with the Russians. IS assumes that if we go in on the ground, we're not going to coordinate with the Russians, and we're going to take a few casualties and go home. If we go in with a tremendous force and we coordinate it with the Russians, we can hammer ISIS, basically catch them between the hammer and the anvil. Russia on one side, us on the other, and a quick, decisive ground victory. On the one hand, it'll show the Wahhabis that we mean business, but it'll also show to any aspiring terrorist organizations that you're not just facing the United States. You're not just facing a demoralized Europe. You're facing a reinvigorated United States and the military might of Russia. Ultimately, even the most daring terrorist organization, at the end of the day, still does not want to face the combined power of two of the world's largest militaries.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator. The In Context Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1. Marshawn and I have been talking most recently about the war in Libya and about the Islamic State's response to its losses in places like Libya and Iraq and Syria by escalating its attacks, its terror attacks in Europe and in other places around the world. Marchand, with regard to the campaign that we've been talking about of terror and our possible response, I'd like to turn to Syria. Can we talk about the war that's been going on there in particular? What's happening with respect to the siege of Aleppo?
Recently, the Russians have opened up a humanitarian corridor into Aleppo. But while the Russians and the Syrian government have surrounded the city, and they are laying siege. The rebels have attempted to break out. There were reports that they had led an effective breakout, but they were later on dismissed. Right now, the noose is tightening around the city. They have continued to conduct a bombing campaign of the city, both the Russians and the Syrian government. And gradually, I think on the one hand, they're starving the rebels out. And then on the other, they're preparing to move into the city once they feel the situation's weak enough. There's also reports that the various jihadi factions are fighting amongst each other in Aleppo. So there isn't necessarily a coordinated resistance.
Recently, a Russian helicopter was shot down by a Syrian rebel ground fire over territory controlled by the U.S.-backed Nusra Front. Nusra was renamed the Syria Conquest Front after it severed its ties with al-Qaeda. In this attack, five Russian soldiers were killed. What do you make of that?
What it appears may have brought this down was, in fact, a surface-to-air missile system. Now, whether we directly supplied it to al-Nusra or whether we supplied it to some of our ne'er-do-well Syrian Democratic Forces allies, it almost doesn't matter how they acquired the weapon. The fact is that it probably was an American-supplied weapon that brought down the helicopter, which the Russians know is almost a way of upping the ante.
Has this incident brought us closer to a confrontation with Russia in Syria?
Oh, it's definitely bringing us much closer to a confrontation. The best example of this escalating situation is the fact that the Russians have launched bombing raids with their Tupolev bombers from a base in Iran. This was reported as of August 16th that Russian bombers flying from Iran began a bombing campaign in Syria. The other thing is that it was also reported in Debka file, the Israeli intelligence newsletter, that the Russians have stationed Su-35s there and that they have already shipped in S-400 surface-to-air missile systems into Iran.
Excuse me, Marshawn, what is an Su-35?
An Su-35 is a Russian fighter bomber. It's a multi-role aircraft. It's one of their most sophisticated aircrafts.
And the missiles you just mentioned?
The S-400 is a surface-to-air missile system, is one of the most sophisticated in the world. We don't know as of yet, but I have heard several naval officers talking off the record who have said that it may be very well be capable of bringing down our most sophisticated stealth aircraft. Again, we don't know what it's capable of because it hasn't shot at any of our aircraft yet, but it is one of the most sophisticated surface-to-air missile systems made to date. And it has been deployed to Iran. So this is an example of the Russians upping the ante. The more sophisticated weapons we supply to the rebels, the more the Russians increase their footprint in the Middle East. For all intents and purposes, who knows, the surface-to-air missile that was used could have been made by the Chinese and bought on the black market. It's entirely possible. The fact is, though, is it very readily plays into the Russian psyche that it may very well have been the Americans, because we are, in fact, supplying missiles and weapons to Islamists. We've supplied anti-tank missiles. We have supplied anti-aircraft missiles. And also, we did supply anti-aircraft missiles to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan when they were fighting the Soviets to bring down Soviet helicopters. So there is a pattern of behavior here that the Russians are seeing. So the Russians realize that for every time we up the ante a little, they up it 100-fold by moving troops into Iran, by increasing their troop numbers in Syria, by becoming more aggressive in Ukraine. All of this is a continual pattern, and it shows how our failing strategy is only making the situation worse and bringing us ever closer to a direct confrontation with the Russians.
Just to remind listeners, the Russians are committed to maintaining the Syrian government. They have had a strong alliance with Syria since the 1970s, and Syria gives the Russians access to the Mediterranean Sea at its port of Tartus, so the Russians are definitely not going to let this country fall. The United States, on the other hand, has been supporting since around 2010, 2011, an insurgency against the Syrian government with the help of allies like Qatar and Saudi Arabia. It's really a superpower fight being done through surrogates. Now, Marshawn, the Iranians have not allowed any foreign military to use its soil for military purposes, such as these Russian bombing runs. What does this say about the state of the relationship between Iran and Russia?
Well, it's definitely gotten closer. What's very important on the world stage, just as in everyday life, is a sense of loyalty. Now, what have we shown our allies in the Middle East and around the world? We've shown them that once it's no longer politically convenient, we will abandon you. That's what we did in Iraq. We told the Iraqis, well, you're on your own. It's your own war now. And they lost half their country to ISIS. We did the same thing in Afghanistan. The Afghan government barely controls Kabul. And we basically pulled away and gone, well, it's your problem. It's not ours anymore. So this has sent a message to everyone in the world that the United States is a fair weather friend. As the Russians have shown, that they are your friend through thick and thin. If you want your regime to stay in power, Russia can and will support you. Libya was harder. Russia did not have a military presence in Libya, nor were they connected by landmass. However, in Syria, Russia made a stand, and they pledged Bashar al-Assad would not fall. So I was watching Fox News, and it was really fascinating because they were saying, any moment now, Bashar al-Assad's going to be ousted from power. In the next couple of hours, Bashar al-Assad will be finished, and Syria will be free. And then a couple of hours later, they're reporting Syrian rebels are retreating in confusion. Syrian rebels are being driven back. We don't understand what's happening. And the very next day, I read reports in Debka File, the Israeli intelligence newsletter, that Russian SOBR counterterrorism units have been spotted on the ground. I was reading articles from the Associated Press that were talking about Russians being spotted on the ground. All of a sudden, the Syrian rebels are being driven back. So what did this demonstrate to every dictator in the world? If you want to stay in power, Russia will be there for you. Russia will be your friend. Russia will ensure at any cost that you stay in power. That is the reason why Iran has decided to allow the Russians to station troops on its territory, because they know it is their security. They know it is their protection, not just against the United States, but against our ne'er-do-well allies as well in the Middle East.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And we should note, Marshawn, that Iran has committed troops to Syria to help the Russians defend the Assad government from the U.S.-backed rebels.
Absolutely. There are reports that there may be as many as close to 100,000 Iranians involved in the fight against ISIS between Iraq and Syria.
In July, Secretary of State Kerry met with the foreign minister of Russia, Lavrov, in France, and discussed Syria. Is there any indication that the United States is moving towards some kind of an understanding with the Russians on Syria?
I think the Russians can tell we're talking through both sides of our mouth at this stage, because on the one hand, we're saying we should cooperate. On the other hand, we're condemning Russia bombing the quote-unquote moderate rebels. So we're saying, let's cooperate in the fight against ISIS, but stop doing what you're doing against our other jihadist rebels that we like. The way the Russians look at it is we're being disingenuous. We're talking through both sides of our mouth. We're telling them, bomb ISIS, but stop bombing these people we like. And don't you dare use the Iranian air bases and stop sending more troops to Syria, but please cooperate with us.
Bomb the bad rebels, but not the good rebels.
Exactly. Bomb the bad jihadists.
Why would the Russians care if the people are shooting at the Syrian government and they're determined to keep the Syrian government in power? Why would they not bomb them?
And to be honest, why should we care? The rebels that we're arming are jihadists as well. At least Bashar al-Assad's a secularist. Bashar al-Assad has never sponsored al-Qaeda. He's never sponsored anyone that's launched an attack on the United States.
You had mentioned that in connection with Libya's leader, Gaddafi. Neither of these governments were fostering jihadist fighters or extremist terrorism. So there really is no rationale for trying to overthrow them in terms of a global war on terror.
The only thing that to me makes sense is that this administration does not like the Russians. It's the only thing I can actually honestly wrap my mind around, because when we look at it from a rational perspective, Viktor Yanukovych, the head of Ukraine, was not sponsoring jihadists either. But then for some reason, we decided to topple his government. Hillary Clinton's State Department was the architect of that. We put in charge a bunch of neo-Nazis. I'm not trying to be colorful here. These guys, the right sector and the Azov Battalion and whatnot, are vocal neo-Nazis who use Nazi symbolism. So it's not an exaggeration. We put these goofballs in power here. We put Islamists in power in Libya, and we're backing Islamists in Syria. This is all a completely irrational reaction. If we're really frightened of terrorism, these aren't the people we should be backing.
Marshawn, in terms of Russian politics in the Mideast, there's been another very important development, which is that Russian President Putin recently met in Russia with the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan in an effort to improve relations between their two countries. The relationship had deteriorated following Turkey's downing of a Russian plane over Syria. Of course, Turkey is supporting the armed forces that are trying to overthrow the Syrian government. They're supporting these forces in cooperation with the United States. Putin invited Erdogan to Moscow for the talks after Turkey apologized for the attack. Now, this warming of Turkish-Russian relations is a particular concern to the U.S. because Turkey is not only a member of NATO, which has really been turned into an anti-Russian military alliance, but Turkey, which borders Syria and Iraq, has the largest military in NATO after the United States, with a personnel numbering over 600,000. So why are Russia and Turkey in conflict in Syria to begin with?
The Turks want to overthrow Bashar al-Assad in order to exert their own influence in Syria. Turkey and Assad have had a sort of hot and cold relationship, and Turkey, I think, sees an opportunity to expand its influence into Syria. But more importantly for the Turks, they didn't like the fact that Bashar al-Assad tolerated and was lenient towards his Kurdish population. Unlike Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Bashar al-Assad did not persecute his Kurdish population. The Turks have had a problem with their own Kurdish population. They've been fighting a Kurdish insurgency, the PKK, which is fighting for an independent Kurdistan. So the Turks have seen this as a useful opportunity, sponsoring Islamist militants or allowing ISIS to use their territory in order to wipe out the Kurds. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, Turkey knows its military is large enough it could pulverize ISIS when it decides the timing is right. So it tolerates and even supports some of these Islamist militants so long as they're wiping out the Kurds, because if there are no Kurds, Turkey has no problem.
And of course, the Kurds have been useful to the anti-jihadist forces in both Iraq and Syria.
Absolutely, because the Kurds, of course, are victims, like the Shiites and the Christians are, of ISIS militants. Now, what's interesting is because the Kurds are Muslims as well, but it is an ethnic war, not a religious one, between ISIS and the Kurds. And ISIS, with a sense of Arab nationalism, seeks to wipe out the Kurds because the Kurds will not submit to ISIS rule. So the Kurds fall, therefore, into the same camp as Bashar al-Assad, the Russians, and even the United States, which is becomes a little weird because both us and the Russians are backing the Kurds, but then we're backing people who are fighting the Kurds, but we're backing the Kurds. It's a little weird in that sense.
Another important aspect of the Turkish-Russian relationship is that a friendly Turkey would be important to protecting Russia's southern flank in the event a war did break out in Eastern Europe against NATO.
Now there is where we get into the reason why Russia sees an opportunity now in Turkey. Russia and Turkey have always been adversaries, not just for historical reasons based on the Ottomans' conquering of Constantinople, because Russia sees itself as the successor to the Eastern Roman Empire. After all, that's the reason why Russia converted to Eastern Orthodoxy as opposed to the Roman Catholic Church. Russia sees itself as the successor to the Eastern Roman Empire, to the Byzantine Empire. So there has been that historical fight between the Turks and the Russians, but much more importantly, Turkey and Russia have vied for control of Russia's southern front. The Crimean War was a war between Turkey and Russia, which the Brits and French sought to exploit in order to threaten Russia from the south. So a friendly Turkey would, for the first time in Russian history, secure Russia's southern front from attack by Russia's opponents. Again, an example, the Crimean War, Britain and France, or even World War I, Russia being threatened by Germany and Austro-Hungary via the Ottoman Empire. What we're seeing now is Russia capitalizing on the fact that Prime Minister Erdogan believes that the United States attempted to overthrow his government. Personally speaking, I do not see why or how the United States would attempt to overthrow Prime Minister Erdogan. Because at the end of the day, he was playing ball with us. There really was nothing we gained by backing these generals. It could have honestly been a Russian false flag in order to frame the CIA. Or it could have been just an organic coup attempt against Erdogan. Nobody at this point can really say for certain. And we probably won't ever know for certain who was really behind the coup.
Our refusal to extradite this Muslim cleric who lives in Pennsylvania, who's been accused by Erdogan of engineering the coup against him, has been a real problem. His name is Fethullah Gulen. And we, of course, say that we will not allow him to be extradited, and the Turkish and the United States governments are at loggerheads over this.
Absolutely. And this is adding credence to Erdogan's theory that we were behind his attempted overthrow. Again, it wouldn't make sense to me. Because he was an American ally, he was anti-Russian, it wouldn't make any sense to me that we would try to overthrow him. That having been said, though, the fact that we won't hand Gulen over does add credence to the fact that Erdogan believes the CIA was behind it. But more to the point, what makes this so crucial is the fact that it means to Erdogan he only has one true friend, and that is Russia. Because as I've said, Russia has proven its loyalty to its friends. So Erdogan, who believes that the CIA is out to get him, that the CIA is harboring Fethullah Gulen in hopes of overthrowing Erdogan to achieve what I'm not certain, if Erdogan believes this, he knows his only true loyal friend is going to be Russia. And therefore, Russia is whom he's going to turn to for security, which means this will secure Russia's southern front. And we've certainly seen trends towards this because Erdogan has said that the United States must choose between Turkey and Gulen, that being part of NATO is no longer a defining factor for Turkey. All of this is demonstrating Turkey's move towards Russia. This is, I think, something that even Putin in his wildest dreams could have only hoped for but never imagined would actually happen.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And we've been most recently talking about the war in Syria and in the very interesting developments in Russian-Turkish relationships and the significance for their apparent reconciliation as regards to NATO. Now, Marshawn, in terms of the Russian-American rivalry confrontation and in terms of the strategic importance of Russia's southern flank in Turkey, we need to talk about the latest developments in the war in the Ukraine, where, of course, you would have mentioned earlier, a few years ago, the United States had assisted in a coup to overthrow the elected pro-Russian president of the Ukraine. He was subsequently replaced with a pro-American government. Shortly thereafter, eastern Ukraine, which is heavily ethnic Russian, has attempted to secede, and there has been continual fighting there between the secessionist forces and the central government of Ukraine and Kiev, backed by the United States. Now, can you talk about the recent firefight at the Ukraine-Crimea border?
Well, the Russians are claiming, and I would like for our history buffs out there to consider the Marco Polo Bridge incident, which occurred in the 1930s in Manchuria. The Russians claim that Ukrainian special forces were sneaking across the border into Crimea to perpetrate acts of terrorism. They were intercepted by the Russians, who then chased them to the border. But when they chased them to the border, somebody shot at somebody else, and Ukrainian and Russian forces were engaging each other. The Russians, of course, had claimed that the Ukrainian army was providing covering fire for its special forces. The Ukrainians, of course, claimed the Russians just started shooting at them. Which perspective is true, I don't know. But what is important is that one Russian service member was killed and one member of the FSB was killed. Now, this is an important provocation for Vladimir Putin because it demonstrates, unlike just ethnic Russians being killed, a Russian service member and a member of the Russian Secret Service has been killed by the Ukrainian army. And that's a very important tool. The other important tool is that they claim, and I emphasize claim because, of course, trying to understand what goes on inside the world of Russian politics, in the words of Winston Churchill, is like trying to watch two cats fight under a rug. But the situation is that the Russians claim to have captured one of these Ukrainian service members who has confessed to being part of Ukrainian special forces, ordered in by the Ministry of Defense to perpetrate acts of terrorism, kill civilians, and has been found with all these bombs. Does to me sound a lot like the Marco Polo Bridge incident when Japanese troops crossed to the Chinese side of the border, started shooting at their own troops in order to spark a firefight between the Chinese and the Japanese and instigate the Second Sino-Japanese War. So this does have that kind of twinge of a false flag. Whether or not that's true, the fact is this has been a provocation which has caused the Russians to mobilize some 40,000 troops into Crimea. There are some 40,000 troops stationed along Crimea. In addition, they appear to have also mobilized troops all along the Ukrainian border. And most importantly, they've centered them in three major locations across the border. What's also crucial is that they've mobilized what appears to be the 20th Guards Tank Army and the 6th Guards Tank Army, which are their major western districts. In total, from what I can estimate, it looks like the Russians have mobilized ballpark around 100,000 troops on the border with Ukraine, possibly more. This is a very large mobilization. They're also conducting war games at this time on the border with Ukraine and in the Crimea. This has been a pattern of Russia conducting war games just prior to an invasion, because just before Russia invaded Georgia back in 2008, the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, the Russians conducted war games just prior to that as cover for the invasion. So I think what we are seeing is this massive mobilization. These war games are taking place. It could just be saber-rattling. It could just be bluster, but it does up the ante significantly. And the way these four major army groups, it appears, are situated along the Ukrainian border, when I looked at a map, it would allow the Russians to drive on Kiev from four angles.
Excuse me, Marshawn, for listeners who may not be familiar with the geography of the region, the Crimea is a large peninsula jutting out of Ukraine into the Black Sea. It's almost like an island. It's connected by a fairly narrow piece of land to the Ukraine and its north, but on its east, it's separated only by a small amount of water from Russia. And I understand the Russians are building some kind of a bridge to actually connect that part of Crimea to Russia.
This may be in order to, again, solidify Russia's claim, but also, again, for strategic purposes, to help facilitate the movement of troops. Again, one of the things that's very interesting, when you look at a map of Ukraine, you look at the placement of these major Russian army groups, you look at the placement of their troops in the Crimea. If they were to invade at this point, situated along the eastern border, situated in Crimea, all they would have to do is drive up from Crimea. They could take the cities of Mariupol and Odessa, completely sever Ukraine from the Black Sea, and then travel right up the Dnieper towards Kiev. That'd be one avenue of approach. The other three avenues of approach from the east would allow the Russians to drive in from the northeast, almost over the top of Ukraine, along the border with Belarus, towards Kiev, because Kiev is more, Kiev is situated at the top of the Dnieper. And then, of course, the other two army groups would allow them to drive through the rebel strongholds. It would basically sever, from one analyst I was reading, it would sever Ukraine from 14 million of its citizens. It would basically completely cut off the eastern half of Ukraine, everything east of Dnieper. So this is why, again, it could just be saber-rattling, but if you wanted to position yourself for an attack on Ukraine, you couldn't set it up any better than this.
Marshawn, of course, the Ukraine was once a part of the Soviet Union. It's one of the republics. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, it became an independent country. Would Russia seek to occupy the entire Ukraine if it invaded, or would it just seek to control the eastern part, which is heavily ethnic Russian?
They may want to permanently station forces in eastern Ukraine, but at the same time, what they may be hoping to achieve is regime change. It's also entirely possible, though, that what the Russians are considering is a reconquest of Ukraine, because Ukraine possesses much of the heavy industry that was essential to the Soviet Union, that was essential to Imperial Russia, a tremendous bed of agriculture. So while what the Russians may be hoping for is to secure a military foothold in a nominally autonomous region within Ukraine, and what they may be looking for is regime change in Kiev if a war were to break out, Russia may see this as their chance. Again, depending on our reaction, if we stand on the sidelines and we just watch, they may change the regime in Kiev and then pull back. However, if we push forward, because remember, we have troops in Western Ukraine, if we were to push in, Russia may see this as the opportunity to regain the Russian Empire. If they know a direct confrontation with the West has become inevitable, even Vladimir Putin himself said that a war between the United States and Russia, particularly the West and Russia, is becoming almost inevitable.
Of course, this is a very scary prospect. A war in Eastern Europe with Russia would have devastating consequences for the Europeans and, of course, the United States. There's the danger that a war in the Ukraine could then quickly escalate and involve, for example, the Baltic republics, which were also once part of the Soviet Union, and where the United States has incorporated them into NATO, where the United States has been conducting large military exercises. So it's certainly a very scary scenario. While the United States is confronting Russia in Syria and Eastern Europe, the Chinese, a very important American rival, has been gaining ground in the Pacific. Satellite photos show that China appears to have built reinforced aircraft hangars on three reefs in the South China Sea Islands. Of course, the Chinese have been laying claim to almost all of the South China Sea. The new hangars have room for any fighter jet in the Chinese Air Force, according to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Just a month ago, an international court in The Hague ruled against China's claim to the South China Sea. We should note that $5 trillion in shipborne trade passes through the South China Sea every year, and there are believed to be great oil and gas reserves under its waters. The Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Brunei have overlapping claims to the South China Sea. Now, Marshawn, does the presence of these new hangars change the military situation in the South China Sea?
Absolutely, because this demonstrates that China isn't just preparing to make a show of force with this island. They are planning for a confrontation by putting in hangars that are meant to be, for lack of a better term, bomb resistant. They're meant to be to make the planes, hopefully, from their perspective, impervious to attack from the air. This means that China's preparing for an actual war. This isn't just a show of force and they figure we'll back down. They're preparing for an actual confrontation whereby we may be trying to bomb this airfield. So this does demonstrate a significant escalation, but it also more importantly demonstrates China's mentality that this isn't just bluster. This isn't just the paper tiger, that China is preparing for an actual showdown with the United States.
And as we've talked about before, our confrontation with Russia has forced Russia into the arms of China. They're not natural allies. And so we're really hurting ourselves two ways with our confrontation with Russia.
China is a threat. China is an immediate threat because China is seizing territory that is not all that far, relatively speaking, from the United States. They control the Pacific. There's not much between them and the United States. And they've demonstrated hostility towards the United States. Russia, on the other hand, we have common ground with. Russia, at the end of the day, we both despise Wahhabi militants, and at the end of the day, we do know what Russia wants, which is security on its border and a buffer zone. That's what Russia has always wanted. That's why we had an understanding with the Russians. Even under the Bush administration, there was an understanding with the Russians. They kept a pro-Russian regime in Ukraine. As a result, they didn't touch any of our NATO allies. There was a balance. We can strike a balance with the Russians. Culturally speaking, the Russians are closer to us. They are a multi-ethnic, multi-religious society. They are, well, albeit a very, well, one can call them a fascist society. It is a dictatorship, but they are not communists anymore. Whereas on the other hand, China still is a communist state, is an avowed atheist state. It clearly is an expansionist state. So China is much more likely to be our adversary. And since their military academy has said that it is training its cadets for a war with its most likely enemy, the United States. So clearly, we are doing a disservice by focusing on the wrong threat. If we were to develop a balance with Russia, I mean, we may never be allies, but if we were to develop a balance, acknowledge that China is equally dangerous to the both of us. Of course, China and Russia have fought border disputes. During the Cold War, they fought each other in engagements with whole tank divisions. So China and Russia have only, even during the Cold War, been allies of convenience. If we can bring Russia into the United States sphere, into our sphere of influence, even just as allies looking to establish a world order, a balance, then we can hem in China. China's security is that we militarily cannot fight a two-front war against the world's two of the three world's largest military superpowers. But if Russia were to be brought in on our side, then we can hem in China. The problem is we are bogging ourselves down in a confrontation with the wrong adversary, and we are not focusing on China.
Well, thank you very much, Marshawn. That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can download the War Report from our website, incontextreport.com, or from WPKN.org by clicking on Podcasts in the upper left-hand corner. The show is also archived at Radio for All. Watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.com. InContextWarReport.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, this is your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.